Chapter 35. At dinner he quietly intimated that Ivan had informed him of my visit, and apologized for not having been able to see me. I, of course, assured him that no apology was necessary, and that we had plenty of time to visit sculpture together without intruding on his private hours. He informed me that he was that afternoon going to pay a visit to Schwanthaler, the sculptor, and if I desired it, he would ask permission on another occasion to take me with him. I jumped at the proposal, as may be supposed. Dinner over, I strolled into the English garden and had my coffee and cigar there. On my return, I was vexed to find that in the hurry of finishing my letters, I had sealed the one to my lawyer and had not enclosed the receipt which had been the object of writing. Fortunately, it was not too late. Descending to the bureau of the hotel, I explained my mistake to the head waiter, who unlocked the letter box to search for my letter. It was found at once, for there were only 7 or 8 in the box. Among these, my eye naturally caught the 3 pink letters which I had that morning seen Ivan drop into the box. But although they were seen by me, they were not noticed at the time, my mind being solely occupied with rectifying the stupid blunder I had made. Once more in my own room, a sudden revelation startled me. Everyone knows what it is to have details come under the eye which the mind first interprets long after the eye ceases to rest upon them. The impressions are received passively, but they are registered, and can be calmly read whenever the mind is in activity. It was so now. I suddenly, as if now for the first time, saw that the addresses on Berganov's letters were written in a fluent, masterly hand, bold in character, and with a certain sweep which might have come from a painter. The thrill which this vision gave will be intelligible when you remember that Berganov had lost or pretended to have lost his right arm, and was, as I before intimated, far from dexterous with his left. That no man recently thrown upon the use of a left hand could have written those addresses was too evident. What, then, was the alternative? The empty sleeve was an imposture. At once the old horrible suspicion returned, and this time with tenfold violence, and with damnatory confirmation. Pressing my temples between my hands, I tried to be calm, and to survey the evidence without precipitation. But for some time the conflict of thoughts was too violent. Whatever might be the explanation, clear it was that Berganov, for some purposes, was practicing a deception, and had, as I knew, other means of disguising his appearance. This, on the most favorable interpretation, branded him with suspicion. This excluded him from the circle of honest men. But did it connect him with the murder of Lieschen Leffold? In my thought it did so indubitably, but I was aware of the difficulty of making this clear to anyone else. My first love, if the reader feels that my suspicions were not wholly unwarranted, were indeed inevitable, he will not laugh at me on learning that once more these suspicions were set aside, and the fact, the damnatory fact, as I regarded it, discovered by me so accidentally, and, I thought, providentially, was robbed of all its significance by Berganov himself casually and carelessly avowing it in conversation, just as one may avow a secret infirmity, with some bitterness, but without any implication of deceit in its concealment. I was the more prepared for this revulsion of feeling by the difficulty I felt in maintaining my suspicions in the presence of one so gentle and so refined. He had come into my room that evening to tell me of his visit to Schwanthaler, and of the sculptor's flattering desire to make my personal acquaintance. He spoke of Schwanthaler, and his earnest efforts in art, with so much enthusiasm, and was altogether so charming, that I felt abashed before him, incapable of ridding myself of the dreadful suspicions, yet incapable of firmly believing him to be what I thought. But more than this, there came the new interest awakened in me by his story, and when, in the course of his story, he accidentally disclosed the fact that he had not lost his arm, all my suspicions vanished at once. We had got, as usual, upon politics, and were differing more than usual, because he gave greater prominence to his sympathy with the Red Republicans. He accused me of not being thoroughgoing, which I admitted. This he attributed to the fact of my giving a divided heart to politics, a condition natural enough at my age, and with my hopes. Well, said I, laughing, you don't mean to take a lofty stand upon your few years' seniority. If my age renders it natural, does yours profoundly alter such a conviction? My age, no. But you have the hopes of youth. I have none. I am banished forever from the joys and sorrows of domestic life, and therefore, to live at all, must consecrate my soul to great abstractions and public affairs. But why banished, unless self-banished? Woman's love is impossible. You look incredulous. I do not allude to this, he said, taking up the empty sleeve, and by so doing sending a shiver through me. The loss of your arm, I said, and my voice trembled slightly, for I felt that a crisis was at hand, although a misfortune to you would really be an advantage in gaining a woman's affections. Women are so romantic, and their imaginations are so easily touched. Yes, he replied bitterly. But the trouble is that I have not lost my arm. I started. He spoke bitterly, yet calmly. I awaited his explanation in great suspense. To have lost my arm in battle, or even by an accident, would perhaps have lent me a charm in woman's eyes. But, as I said, my arm hangs by my side withered, unpresentable. I breathed again. He continued in the same tone, and without noticing my looks. But it is not this which banishes me. Woman's love might be hoped for, had I far worse infirmities. The cause lies deeper. It lies in my history. A wall of granite has grown up between me and the sex. But, my dear fellow, do you wounded, as I presume to guess, by some unworthy woman extend the fault of one to the whole sex? Do you despair of finding another true, because a first was false? They are all false, he exclaimed with energy. Not, perhaps, all false from inherent viciousness, though many are that, but false because their inherent weakness renders them incapable of truth. Oh, I know the catalogue of their good qualities. They are often pitiful, self-devoting, generous, but they are so by fits and starts, just as they are cruel, remorseless, exacting, by fits and starts. They have no constancy, they are too weak to be constant even in evil, their minds are all impressions, their actions are all the issue of immediate promptings. Swayed by the fleeting impulses of the hour, they have only one persistent, calculable motive on which reliance can always be placed, that motive is vanity, you are always sure of them there. It is from vanity they are good, from vanity they are evil, their devotion and their desertion equally vanity. I know them. To me they have disclosed the shallows of their natures. God! How I have suffered from them! A deep, low exclamation, half sob, half curse, closed his tirade. He remained silent for a few minutes, looking on the floor, then, suddenly turning his eyes upon me, said, "Were you ever in Heidelberg?" "Never." "I thought all your countrymen went there? Then you will never have heard anything of my story. Shall I tell you how my youth was blighted? Will you care to listen? It would interest me much." "I had reached the age of 27, he began, without having once known even the vague stirrings of the passion of love. I admired many women, and courted the admiration of them all, but I was as yet not only heart whole, but, to use your Shakespeare's phrase, Cupid had not tapped me on the shoulder. This detail is not unimportant in my story. You may possibly have observed that in those passionate natures which reserve their force, and do not fritter away their feelings in scattered flirtations or trivial love affairs, there is a velocity and momentum, when the movement of passion is once excited, greatly transcending all that is ever felt by expansive and expressive natures. Slow to be moved, when they do move it is with the whole mass of the heart. So it was with me. I purchased my immunity from earlier entanglements by the price of my whole life. I am not what I was. Between my past and present self there is a gulf. That gulf is dark, stormy, and profound. On the far side stands a youth of hope, energy, ambition, and unclouded happiness, with great capacities for loving. On this side a blighted manhood, with no prospects but suffering and storm. He paused. With an effort he seemed to master the suggestions which crowded upon his memory, and continued his narrative in an equable tone. I had been for several weeks at Heidelberg. One of my intimate companions was Kessner, the architect, and he one day proposed to introduce me to his sister-in-law, Ottilie, of whom he had repeatedly spoken to me in terms of great affection and esteem. We went, and we were most cordially received. Ottilie justified Kessner's praises. Pretty, but not strikingly so clever, but not obtrusively so. Her soft dark eyes were frank and winning. Her manner was gentle and retiring, with that dash of sentimentalism which seems native to all German girls, but without any of the ridiculous extravagance too often seen in them. I liked her all the more, because I was perfectly at my ease with her, and this was rarely the case in my relations to young women. I don't enjoy their society. You leap at once to the conclusion that we fell in love. Your conclusion is precipitate. Seeing her continually, I grew to admire and respect her, but the significant smiles, winks, and hints of friends, pointing unmistakably at a supposed understanding existing between us, only made me more seriously examine the state of my feelings, and assured me that I was not in love. It is true that I felt a serene pleasure in her society, and that when away from her, she occupied much of my thoughts. It is true that I often thought of her as a wife, and in these meditations she appeared as one eminently calculated to make a happy home. But it is no less true that during a temporary absence of hers of a few weeks I felt no sort of uneasiness, no yearning for her presence, no vacancy in my life. I knew, therefore, that it was not love which I felt. So much for my feelings. What of hers? They seemed very like my own. That she admired me, and was pleased to be with me, was certain. That she had a particle of fiery love for me I did not, could not believe. And it was probably this very sense of her calmness which kept my feelings quiet. For love is a flame which often can be kindled only by contact with flame. Certainly this is so in proud, reserved natures, which are chilled by any contact with temperature not higher than their own. On her return, however, from that absence I have mentioned, I was not a little fluttered by an obvious change in her manner, an impression which subsequent meetings only served to confirm. Although still very quiet, her manner had become more tender, and it had that delicious shyness which is the most exquisite of flatteries, as it is one of the most enchanting of graces. I saw her tremble slightly beneath my voice, and blush beneath my gaze. There was no mistaking these signs. It was clear that she loved me, and it was no less clear that I, taking fire at this discovery, was myself rapidly falling in love. I will not keep you from my story by idle reflections. Take another cigar. He rose and paced up and down the room in silence. Via Agalma, at this juncture there arrived from Paris the woman to whom the great sorrow of my life is due. A fatalist might read in her appearance at this particular moment the signs of a prearranged doom. A few weeks later, and her arrival would have been harmless. I should have been shielded from all external influence by the absorbing force of love. But, alas, this was not to be. My fate had taken another direction. The woman had arrived whose shadow was to darken the rest of my existence. That woman was Agalma Liebenstein. How is it that the head which we can only see surrounded with a halo, or a shadow, when the splendors of achievement or the infamy of shame instruct our eyes, is by the uninstructed eye observed as wholly vulgar? We all profess to be physiognomists. How is it we are so lamentably mistaken in our judgments? Here was a woman in whom my ignorant eyes saw nothing at all remarkable except golden hair of unusual beauty. When I say golden, I am not speaking loosely. I do not mean red or flaxen hair, but hair actually resembling burnished gold more than anything else. Its ripples on her brow caught the light like a coronet. This was her one beauty, and it was superb. For the rest, her features were characterless. Her figure was tall and full, not graceful, but sweepingly imposing. At first I noticed nothing about her except the braided splendor of her glorious hair. He rose, and went into his bedroom, from which he returned with a small trinket box in his hand. This he laid open on the table, disclosing a long strand of exquisite fair hair lying on a cushion of dark blue velvet. "Look at that," he said. "Might it not have been cut from an angel's head? It is certainly wonderful. It must have been hair like this which crowned the infamous head of Lucrezia Borgia," he said, bitterly. "She, too, had golden hair, but hers must have been of paler tint, like her nature." He resumed his seat, and, fixing his eyes upon the lock, continued. "She was one of Adelie's friends, dear friends. They called each other, which meant that they kissed each other profusely, and told each other all their secrets, or as much as the lying nature of the sex permitted and suggested. It is, of course, impossible for me to disentangle my present knowledge from my past impressions so as to give you a clear description of what I then thought of Agalma. Enough that, as a matter of fact, I distinctly remember not to have admired her, and to have told Adelie so, and when Adelie, in surprise at my insensibility, assured me that men were in general wonderfully charmed with her, though, for her part, she had never understood why, I answered, and answered sincerely, that it might be true with the less refined order of men, but men of taste would certainly be rather repelled from her. This opinion of mine, or some report of it, reached Agalma. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.